I really enjoy our Wednesday night meetings probably more than even our Sunday morning times. It just seems like they're very rich with fellowship and rich with the Word, and definitely looking forward to that. And then also, once again, on the 16th, the Dignity Roasters is going to be coming to the McFarland's place, and they're going to be talking to us about how their lives were literally turned upside down for ministry, and they kind of turned it around. I don't want to take the thunder out of the bag, but they turned everything around as far as ministry is concerned and just giving to people, and they have a very different approach, and so I'm looking forward to that. And then on the 23rd, we're going to be meeting at the Flood's place. So leading up into this Wednesday night, I want to share some thoughts with you this morning that I think are very helpful for us. This last week I was reading, and Matthew Henry said, "Those that are void of compassion are so far void of understanding." Let me just read it again. "Those that are void of compassion are so far void of understanding." Then he goes on to say, "Where there is not the tenderness of a man, one may question whether there be any understanding of a man." This is a very interesting statement that he made. I'm going to say it again because it's a little bit wordy. Those that are void of understanding are so far void, I'm sorry, those that are void of compassion are so far void of understanding. Where there is not the tenderness of a man, one may question whether there be the understanding of a man. This is an interesting statement for a number of reasons. When we tend to think of compassion and logic, or compassion and understanding, we tend to view them as being almost on separate ends of the spectrum. We tend to view them as almost being enemies of one another. Let me tell you why that's the case. How many of you have husbands and wives? How many of you as dads and moms have ever had this discussion? Well, that kid needs to know what's right. They need to know what the rule is, and they're going to follow the rule. And the other spouse or the other parent is saying, "Yes, but honey, we need to be understanding. We need to be forgiving." And have you ever had that happen in your home? I know that we're probably the only set of parents where that's happened. But you'll see there that because we go through that discussion as parents, and when you lead organizations and as you just go through life, we tend to view compassion and understanding as, once again, two separate foes, if you will, as if they're at odds with one another. And this is why this statement that Matthew Henry said stuck out to me so much. Those that are void of compassion are also void of understanding. John chapter 1 and verse number 14. Let's start reading there this morning for a few moments. John 1 and verse 14. The Bible says something about Jesus that would really back up what Mr. Henry says. John 1 and verse 14 says this, that he came unto his own, I'm sorry, John 1 and 14 says, "And the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld his glory, the glory as of the only begotten of the Father." And look what the Bible says, full. And then notice how in unison these two work together. Jesus represented both of these because and that is full of grace and truth. Notice that Jesus was a representation of both of those. I think it's interesting. Let's go to Proverbs 11 and verse number 12. Proverbs 11 and verse number 12 this morning. And let's take a look. Proverbs 11 and verse number 12. Notice here how God ties in our compassion or our lack thereof with our knowledge base and our understanding. I want us to take a look at this morning because, once again, I think that we tend to view these as two opposite foes of one another. Look what Proverbs 11 and verse number 12 says. Actually, Proverbs 11 and verse number 12. "He that is void of wisdom despiseth his neighbor." Let's stop. We would typically think of it like this. A cold-hearted person is going to despise his neighbor. Somebody who has shut up the bowels of compassion, he's going to despise his neighbor. Somebody who just doesn't have much passion for people, he's going to despise his neighbor. Actually, Proverbs says it very differently. "He that is void of wisdom despiseth his neighbor, but a man of understanding holdeth his peace." And you see here, the Bible says once again that John 1:14, that Jesus is full of what? Grace and truth. They're not at odds with one another. He was a representation of both of those. They were both simultaneously working together. "He that is void of wisdom despiseth his neighbor." Let's go to Proverbs 28 and verse number 16. Proverbs 28 in verse number 16. Proverbs 28 and verse number 16. Let's look at what Proverbs says here. "The prince that wanteth," in the King James that means lacks, "the prince that wanteth understanding," or lacks understanding, is also a great oppressor. So you would think a cold-hearted prince is a great oppressor. Somebody who never opens up their emotions to other people, he's a great oppressor. Actually, it's very different. Notice what the scripture says here. It says once again that a prince that wants or lacks understanding is also a great oppressor. But he that hateth covetousness, he says, shall prolong his days. Now, I want to take a few moments this morning. I want to challenge our hearts that if we are not a compassionate people, if we're not actively loving people, that's what we're going to talk about Wednesday night as we listen to Bob Goff. And I was able to get him here just on a moment's notice. It's incredible via YouTube. But what we tend to do, what we tend to think is that what we need to understand is that if we are not stepping out as Jesus stepped out, we have to understand that it's not just that, well, I'm feeling a little bit cold-hearted. I'm just, I really need to open my heart up to other people. But the opposite of understanding is actually foolishness. And I want to logically deal with a very heart-filled subject this morning. And I want to logically pull you to being a compassionate people this morning. But before we even talk about that, we've got a big problem here this morning. Before we even venture into this subject, we have a huge problem this morning. And here's the problem. Does anybody know what the problem is? The problem is that every person in the world thinks that they're compassionate. Is that true? Every person that you meet thinks that they're a forgiving person. I'm basically a forgiving person. Every person thinks they're a giving person. Every person, if you were to quiz them, if you were to question them, they think that they already have compassion. Here's why. Because we tend to measure compassion by sentiment rather than doing. And so when we tend to see somebody reactively, does anybody know what that means, children, reactively? In other words, we don't go out of our way to make this a part of our life. But reactively means that we're just kind of going through our life. We see something, and what happens is we see something that, let's say we're at a shopping mall, and we see a family that's in a very difficult spot, and that happens quite often. And let's say that we see a situation that's just sad, if you will. I saw a dad dealing with a son a few years ago in Walmart, and I was absolutely horrified by what I saw, the way he was dealing with the child. And what was interesting is that we tend to see those situations and we tend to feel bad inside, do we not? I mean, hopefully there's a part of us, hopefully even the worst of criminals, hopefully even the worst of people in the world, they still have a part of themselves that feels something bad inside when they see something go down that's difficult. But we tend to think that because we feel that when we see bad situations, that we're a compassionate people. And I want you to know that nothing can be absolutely further from the truth. One of the things that we're going to look at today, God willing, is that God distinguishes the saved from the unsaved, not by a prayer that was prayed, Matthew 25, but by, as we talked about 2 weeks ago, our love for other people. You know, I kind of wonder if we, rather than saying saved and unsaved, I kind of wonder, according to Matthew 25, if we ought to categorize people rather than save and unsave, but it may actually more speak to our minds if we would say givers, sacrificers, and pleasure seekers. Now, that'd be a little bit different, wouldn't it? Now, that's a little bit difficult because you say, well, I know people that are saved, but they still seek after pleasure. I get all that, but if you look at Matthew 25, Jesus' distinguishing mark between the sheep and the goats, what was it? And so when you saw me naked, you clothed me. When you saw me in prison, you visited me. And Jesus' distinguishing mark, because the goat said, well, when did we see you? And once again, he said, when you saw me naked, you basically saw me. And when you didn't give to them, you didn't give to me. And I really was thinking this week, rather than just thinking the saved and the unsaved, because the distinguishing mark between the sheep and the goats was those that were just living for themselves and those that were sacrificers for others. So rather than just lost and found, saved and unsaved, I wonder if it'd be interesting for us just to start saying, sacrificers, are you a sacrificer or a pleasure seeker? That would be pretty radical, wouldn't it? That'd be a pretty interesting way to talk about it. But are you a sacrificer? What do you mean a sacrificer? I mean a Christian. Well, I mean, I'm saved, but I have a hard time giving. Well, wait a second. Because we know that we have passed from death unto life if we what? If we love the brethren. And we're going to talk about this in a few moments here. But what if we started approaching that way? Rather than saved and unsaved, lost and found, are you a sacrificer or are you a pleasure seeker? That would be an interesting delineation. And it would be a scriptural one at that. Now, compassion. The problem with this message is that I could literally waste 45 minutes to an hour here. And by the way, I paid Brian House to speak last week. And I told him, please preach for an hour and a half. So that the people think that I preach short sermons. And he accomplished what I asked him to do. So, we had to use 7 SD cards. So, he used to actually be a pastor at a Spanish church. And he said they would meet for 3 to 5 hours on a Sunday. So, he said they would preach for an hour and a half, eat, and then preach for another hour and a half. So he said this was a short sermon last week. So, compassion is not just intermittently feeling sorry for other people. Anybody can do that. But compassion, actually, let's go to 1 John 3 and verse 18, is measured by not just what we feel inside. I believe that has to be part of it, but it's also what we do. See, Jesus didn't say to the sheep and the goats, when you saw me naked, you really felt bad for me. When you saw me in prison, you really felt something inside. When you saw me hungry, boy, you really had a good vibe inside. And we tend to do this with love. We tend to measure by feeling, measure by sentiment. We do this with forgiveness all the time. We tend to measure forgiveness by sentiment rather than what we actually do towards somebody. We also tend to measure forgiveness by what we didn't do rather than what we do. Boy, if they knew what I wanted to do to them, they'd be sorry. And we tend to think that because we didn't do something that we're forgiving people, and that's not the case. But 1 John 3 and verse 18 says this. It says, my little children, let us not love in word, neither in tongue, but in deed and in truth. We see love is measured by action. Obviously, for God so loved the world that he what? Children, can you say it? For God so loved the world that he what? He gave his only begotten son. God didn't love. Imagine if God sat in eternity past and said, boy, I really feel sorry for that world. Boy, that's just a shame what's going on. And I tell you, I am just about convinced beyond a shadow of a doubt that we measure love based on sentiment and the fact that we feel bad for something. But what are we actually doing for other people? Let's understand this, that the most proactive, life-changing, culture-shifting maneuver that ever took place in the history of the world is when Christ left the throne of glory and came to this earth. The very God, the very God that gives us everything that we have today, participated in, listen now, the most proactive, life-changing, culture-shifting maneuver was Christ coming to us. Think about the shift that he had in his lifestyle when he started his ministry. And one of the things that I've been saying over and over again, and I don't know if you guys read the article that I posted on Facebook, why committed Christians are going to church even less and less. You know, I've been saying this for the last year, but it is hard to corral American sheep. And that's why I don't do it. But it's very difficult to corral American sheep. A pastor is to feed sheep. But to corral a prosperous, sheepish nation, if you will, it's extremely difficult. And that article I put on Facebook, I think I ought to put it on our church page also. It was written a couple years ago by why committed Christians aren't going to church. And one of the number one things is affluence. And once we get money, we have money to travel. We have money to involve our children in sports competitions, which many times are on Sundays and Wednesday evenings. And thank the Lord for programs like Heart Basketball. We have a no Wednesday night, no Sunday policy. Oak Grinder Baseball, no Wednesday night, no Sunday policy. But here's the point is this, is that Jesus... Imagine the shift in lifestyle. Because one of the things I've been saying as of late is just because you can doesn't mean you should do something. And I don't know that we're the greatest at ascertaining that. Just because you can do something doesn't mean you should do something. I believe a committed Christian is probably saying no more than he's saying yes to things in his life. And he's saying, I could do that, but I'm not so sure that that aids me in my family. I don't think that aids me in my walk with God. I don't think that, that helps me to be a building block in the body of Christ, because we're to be accountable to one another. But think about Jesus and his lifestyle. Not only did he come out of heaven, once again, the most proactive, life-changing, culture-shifting maneuver is Christ stepping out of heaven. And guess what? It's for us. It wasn't measured by sentiment. It's what he did. He came out of heaven, comes to earth, but then 30 years into life, I'm sure he was a very successful carpenter. I mean, I can't even imagine how precise his work must have been. The last house I lived in, many of you would visit our barn, and if you would go to the barn, the man was so maniacal about his tools being in place. And I know, by the way, that I've reached old age because I have a tool set that I've used probably every week for the last 8 months, and I have not lost one thing out of that tool set. I have reached old age, okay? Although I was disturbed because I went to my dad's barn, he had a lot of tools out of place, and I was thinking, I had a different picture of this. But what's interesting is that in our old barn, the man had a tool shelf, and he had painted on the wall each individual tools and the shape of the tools where they went. So if it was a hammer, if it was a screwdriver, if it was a wrench, even the size of the wrenches. He had them all painted on the side of the wall. Many of you remember that if you remember going there. And you just walk in there and you go, okay, this guy was really maniacal about his tools being in place. And when you went inside the house, even though it was an old house, it was amazing how flush all the paneling was. It was amazing. He put the tile ceiling in the main part of the house, and it was actually convicting how straight the tile was that he had put in place. And I have no idea how slow he went, because I would just be like, get it done. I could care less what it looks like. That would be me if I did that. Now, here's the thing, though, is that imagine Jesus. I would imagine he was a successful carpenter, extremely successful. But we see him leaving not only the throne of heaven, we see him leaving even that vocation. And what we see is once again, we see a shift taking place. What this first part of the year is for us and for me in dealing with our body is a shift taking place. That the end cannot be us just come in here and listen and just keep prospering, and then, you know, we give a little bit of time to God. That's not Christianity at all, as we're going to look at this morning. This is why we're going to start, God willing, Wednesday evening with an evening with Bob Goff. And his book, I think, is so popular because I think that it, one of the things it's doing is it's causing you to have to think very, very differently about your life and even your work. One of the greatest things he says in the book is this, in my opinion, is that when he started viewing his attorney work as a way to fund ministry, his energy level for attorney work went sky high. And he all of a sudden had new vision and new purpose with his work as an attorney. Many of us, and I tried to share with some of the young men in the church that you have to find a way to stay motivated to work as a man. And if it's just for things, that's gonna, honestly, at some point, that's not gonna be enough. But when you realize that God has given you a job to make money to fund ministry and to find something that is radical, something that God is involved with, and move your money towards that, guess what? There's a new spring in your step on Monday morning when you go to work. There's a new reason to make that sale. There's a new reason to grow everything. If it's just to have a big 401k, if it's just so I can have a nicer car, a nicer house, that has nothing to do with why Christ walked this earth. Because Christ was perfectly fine in heaven before he came to us. And we see at the prime of his life, he makes a second shift. And the shift is to give himself to ministry, knowing it would end in death in his life. Lost and saved, I really think we need to use a different term this morning. Sacrificers and pleasure seekers. I think we ought to start using that term. That gives you no wiggle room. And that shows you what the end result is. Jesus said, by this shall all men know that you are my disciples, if you have, what? Love one towards another. If you want to automatically invigorate your Christianity, if you're feeling like, I just feel so far from God, go out and find someone who needs something and give to them in the name of Christ and open up their heart, because a gift prepares a way for you, and open up their heart and have a chance to share with them about Christ. You are going to totally invigorate and energize your Christian walk. And you're going to find yourself wanting to read the Bible, wanting to pray. You're going to find yourself, you're going to find that your thoughts are going to be purer, they're going to be holier, they're going to be better, they're going to be more in tune with God. And you're going to find that just the raw reading of the Word will bless your heart as a result of that. 1 John 3:18. Love not in word, neither in tongue, but in deed and in truth. Jesus made a shift coming out of heaven. Look at the apostles. Look at the shift that they made. As you read through the book of Romans, do you not go, the apostle Paul, what an amazingly intelligent man. A man who was probably at the height of his career, a man who could have excelled greatly in the ranks of his work. Let's understand this, that he, all of a sudden, he has an encounter with Christ and gives himself to the preaching of the gospel. And you know one of the great frustrations of the Apostle Paul is? If you read carefully the scriptures, his great frustration was caused by the fact that he gave his all for the gospel of Christ, and his great frustration was that other people didn't. If you read through that, let's understand this, that compassion says, what do I need to be thinking about today beside myself? Compassion says, who do I need to be thinking about today beside myself? Compassion says, what can I do with the resources I have to bless someone today? Compassion says, who needs to be thought about that no one else is thinking about today? That's what compassion says. We are in the middle of a horrible, horrific epidemic that's taking place in our society. And the epidemic is this. There's very, 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 very few givers and a lot of takers. And you've heard my teaching on this before. A lot of it, I think, comes from the fast-paced society. A lot of it comes from, I think, the breakdown of the family. There's a number of reasons for this. I call it the Walmart syndrome. If you're in business and I'm in business in the same town, I like to deal with locally family-owned and operated businesses. The reason why that's the case, and we try to do that as much as possible, the reason why that's the case is if I have to live with you and you have to live with me in the same small town for a long time, we're going to treat each other a lot better. But the more that you walk into a corporation, you don't know the owner, and they're just some board far off, and it's all owned by stocks, and there's no personal touch to it, you subconsciously go into that place thinking this, man, I just need to get a deal, and they can take the hit. It doesn't matter if they even take a financial hit. And you know what you end up with? We end up with a society where we could care less about who's running things, what's keeping things going, and we end up with lots of takers. And guess what we end up with? Just a few givers, a few providers in life. And here's why I say this. It seems like there's very few people that sit around and go, what is going on in that other person's life today? It seems like there's very few people who are in a room, you've heard me talk about this before, and go, who else is in the room? What do they need? And how can I bless them? It seems like there's almost this like energy about people where they're in a place and it's just almost like there's a bubble around them, and it's all about just they're in their zone and they can't see anything, they can't see anyone, and they're not thinking about where the needs are. Christ was in a good zone, and he comes out of that zone, comes out of that bubble, and comes to this world. And I'm telling you, this is an absolute epidemic. Debbie Pearl said it very well in her article that we read on a few Wednesday nights ago, about 6 or 7 months ago, that she said that an older person will be walking into a room and carrying a large object, and teenagers will be seven or eight teenagers will be sitting there, and that older person will be struggling carrying it, and they won't even move whatsoever. It's an epidemic today. And the idea is that because of the bubble that people are in, that people are just not aware that, hey, that older person may need help. And it's an absolute epidemic, and I think that it's infected the church more than we realize. It's infected the body of Christ. And we have to consciously retrain our brain to go, once again, compassion says, who do I need to be thinking about today beside myself? What can I do with the resources that I have to bless someone today? Who needs to be thought about that no one else is thinking about today? To test my theory on whether or not I'm right, go do something for someone and see how absolutely shocked they are. You've heard me talk about this before. But I want to encourage us that this spirit of this age, once again, of just being in a room, being in a place, living your life, you're in your own little bubble, I want to encourage you to defy that. And I want to encourage you because that is the spirit of Christ. Christ could have stayed in his bubble. He was with the Father. He shared the glory with the Father. He could have stayed there and we would have all have been lost. Compassion. Compassion says, what can I do that will generate a feeling of sacrifice within myself? Compassion just doesn't say, okay, I feel bad for that person. Okay, I need to just kind of throw them kind of the overflow of what I have. But compassion also says, what can I do that will generate a feeling of sacrifice? And remember, a sacrifice is not a sacrifice until, guess what? It's a sacrifice. And until something hurts, until something's hard, and even I'm going to say until something is awkward and makes you a little afraid to do it, it's probably not a sacrifice for us. Let's go to Hebrews chapter 10 and verse 34. This is not just a sermon this morning. This is something that is absolutely on my mind and on my heart that we as a body of believers need to keep fanning this flame. Hebrews 10 in verse 34. I had somebody call. Actually, for some reason, I had a couple people call me about the church the last few weeks. And actually, I've had about three families over the last 4 or 5 weeks call about the church. And it's always interesting the questions that people ask when they call about the church. One of the things I've started to do is rather than act like I'm being interviewed and that we're trying to sell something, is I turn it around. And one of the things that I try to say to people is, hold on a second, I'm not sure where you're coming from on this, but we're not really just about you having your needs met. Hopefully, we're a body of believers in flux and that we're flexible and we don't have this whole thing figured out. And we're trying to become sacrificers rather than pleasers. And as people call and ask me questions about the church, I'm learning to turn this thing around and say, you know, I really don't like the premise of your questions. This is how we stay small at Crossroads. But listen, but it is true, because as somebody who studies the Word and understands Christianity, the premise of their questions is all about themselves. What kind of children's programs do you have? Do you have the kind of music that we like? And then some people are so caught up in little theological boxes. I stopped a guy in conversation this last week. I said, you know, I don't really even believe that Christianity is all about what you're talking about. Hebrews 10 and verse 34 says this. For ye had compassion of me in my bonds, and took joyfully the spoiling of your goods, knowing in yourselves that ye have in heaven a better and an enduring substance. There is so much in this verse right here. So the reason why, first of all, we can give is because we don't really have a lot at stake as Christians. People say, well, you know, I've got retirement and I understand all that. There's nothing, you know, you've heard my teaching on that. John Wesley said, earn all you can, save all you can, give all you can. So we only have so much at stake, though, because in heaven, we have a better and an enduring substance. But look what he says. For ye had compassion on me in my bonds. And I believe this is the Apostle Paul talking. And took joyfully, and notice the word that's used here, the spoiling of your goods. So children, do you know what this means? In other words, that the writer of Hebrews here is saying this. He's saying that you met my needs, and you allowed your goods, your material assets, to be spoiled. And here's what's interesting. The word spoil, that's a very intriguing word that's used here. You know what it really means? It literally means to plunder or to rob. You allowed your material assets to be robbed so that I could have my needs met. Or the ministry team that was with Paul, I believe, could have their needs met. Now here's what's interesting. The word spoil here, it's translated two other times in the New Testament. Let's look real quick. I want some of our young men, I don't see Joey here this morning. We're here. Let's take a look here. Randy, do you have your Bible? If you could turn to Matthew 23, 25. Look where this Greek word, look how it's translated in two other places. Where's Luke? Could you, is it Luke? Sorry. Could you read, I always get the Oxendine boys messed up. So Luke 11, 39, I thoroughly thought to myself, I've got a 33% chance of getting this right. So today I can play the lottery. Maybe it'll carry over to you. So if you could turn to Luke 11, 39, it'd be great. So he says here, you allowed joyfully the spoiling of your goods. And remember, we're asking the question, what is compassion? And one of the things we need to ask ourselves is, what can I do that will generate a feeling of sacrifice? We're not talking about just a 5%, 10% writing a check. We're not talking about just feeling sorry for somebody. But Hebrews said, you took joyfully the spoiling of your goods. The word spoiling literally means an act of plundering or robbery. Have you ever been robbed before? I actually had my van broken into at the boys' club about 2 or 3 months ago. I was fuming mad. And I was thinking, I'm one of those guys that I've often ran this scenario through my mind, that if I was at an ATM and I pulled out $10 from an ATM and somebody came up and snatched it, Proverbs says, now my wife says I can come up with a verse for anything, but Proverbs says that the substance of a diligent man is precious to him. I really believe that I would chase that man down for 25 miles, not to get my $10 back, because once I caught him, I'd probably give it back to him, but I would just be so mad that somebody took $10 of something that I earned and worked so hard for, okay? And I was robbed. Somebody broke into our van and took all of our cables out. It was about $40 worth of cables. Two of our chargers, our nice dual charger. Then I had a wireless charger with it. I'm sure they're on eBay right now selling for quite a bit. But what was interesting, in the Smiths, a couple nights before that, same place. By the way, lock your doors at the boys' club. They had one of their phones taken out of their vehicle. You feel violated when you've been robbed. I know the Mooneyhands, you guys were broken into a number of years ago, I think when you guys lived either on the shores or 18th Avenue. It didn't feel good, did it? You feel violated. But God says that these people joyfully gave to the ministry. Look what he says here. Now keep in mind, I don't know how you're filtering this. If you're at Crossroads, I think you're filtering this correctly, because we don't preach messages like this. You know, it's for you can give to a building program. We want you to go out, honestly, and we want you to give to the ministry, to give to the needs of others. We don't need a lot of money to subsist as a church body. We pay our rent once a month, and church gives me a little bit just so I don't get grumpy about what I do from time to time. But what's interesting is this, is that he says here, they took joyfully the spoiling of your goods. This Greek word that's translated spoiling, it's only used two other times in the Bible. Matthew 23, 25. Can you read that real quick, if you don't mind? Read it real loud, if you don't mind. That word, do you know the word, that same word that is translated spoiling is actually translated extortion in that verse. Luke 11, 39. Does extortion hurt? I've never been extorted, but I think it does. Luke 11, 39. Read that, if you don't mind, Luke.
And the Lord said to him, now do you, Pharisees, make clean outside the cup and the glass, but your inward part is the full radiating in wickedness. You fool, not he that made that which is without make the that which is within also, but rather give all of
So, yeah, very, very good. That completes the verse. Thank you very much, Luke. The word ravening and wickedness, is the word ravening is the same word. You know, I think of something that's ravenous. You know, I think of somebody, something that's taking something. And God says, God's complimenting these people because they gave to the point where they actually felt like they were being robbed, extorted. Somebody who was ravenous was almost hurting them, but they did it joyfully. If giving doesn't hurt at times, is it really a sacrifice? You see, if a man that owned 1,000 cattle only sacrifices one of them, is it really a sacrifice? But remember, in the Old Testament, when you see Solomon and Abraham and all these men giving multitudes of sacrifices, money was cattle. Money was the stock that they had. And here's the point, that it hurt. It did something in their brain. David Ramsey, has anyone ever taken his course where he talks about paying with a credit card versus paying with a credit card versus paying with cash? They have proven scientifically that when you pay with a credit card versus a debit card versus cash, that the further down you go in that it's more painful. When you pay for cash for something, with cash for something, it actually hurts you inside. There's a certain level of pain that's there. When it's a debit card, it's painful, but it's not as painful. When it's credit card, you don't even feel it until about a year later. Then you really, really feel it. Here's the point. Giving ought to hurt. And I'm going to ask the question, what are we doing that hurts us? If not, we're self-deceived. We're just a group of fellowshippers. We're just getting together and we love each other. And remember, we can think that we're real loving people, but remember, those that don't like us are gone. So we keep that in mind. Churches can be self-deceived in thinking that we're real loving people, but those that they don't love aren't there. And so we can think that we're real loving people, but we're not. And the point being is this, is fellowship is great, and I appreciate the fact that it is biblical fellowship. I hear spiritual conversations going on all the time. And I'm not saying that we're not givers, but I'm trying to affect you the way that I am being affected as a Christian right now, and that my wife is being affected. Compassion says, what can I do that will generate a feeling of sacrifice? I'm going to say pain. Something where you feel like something ravenous has affected you. Something where you feel like you've almost been extorted. Something where you feel like you've been spoiled, that like an enemy has almost come in and taken something from you. It's an interesting concept this morning. Compassion says, what can I do that will cause others to think that I've gone mad? Let's go to Mark 3 and verse 21. Mark 3 and verse 21. I was a varsity basketball player in Muskuta, Illinois, and I got saved around March of my senior year. I was in Bible college by December, and I'll never forget that the word on the street was, did you hear about Butch? Not Butch Oxendine, but that was my nickname. You hear about Butch? Because every once in a while, you guys call Butch's name out, and I turn my head. But did you hear about Butch? They said, he's turned to the cloth. That's what they said. Well, there's a moment here where they say something about Jesus that's almost like that. Mark 3 and verse 21 says, and when his friends heard of it, about Jesus, they went out to lay hold on him, for they said, he is beside himself. Think of the apostles. Paul comes from a family where I'm sure that he was educated by parents who secured a great education. And you have to wonder, do we ever consider, what did Paul's family think about him giving himself to the ministry? What about Peter? What was Peter known for before that time? Well, how did his dad talk about him? We dads, we talk about our children, hopefully in a good way. And, you know, we like to talk about what our children are doing. When you see the Super Bowl in January, Mark, with the company that he's working for, they're actually doing some of the aerial work for that. So I'm going to sit there and watch the Super Bowl with some of my friends, maybe, and go, yeah, my son, he did that little shot there. We like to talk that way about our children, don't we? What about Peter's parents? Did they sit around and go, he's a good worker, he is a solid businessman, And he gave all that up for ministry and to end his life being hung upside down. This is the Spirit of Christ. So are you lost? Are you saved? I'm going to ask, are you a sacrificer or are you a pleasure seeker? Notice this here. Understanding. Why is it that understanding leads to compassion? Let's go to Colossians 4 in verse number 1. Colossians 4 in verse number 1. Understanding should lead to compassion. And I believe the reason why understanding leads to compassion, first of all, is because I think we have to ask the question, it's kind of a statement and a question, are we better than our own Creator? And the Bible even alludes to this in Colossians 4 in verse number 1. As God talks about the master-servant relationship, he's going to talk to masters about how they treat their servants. And I want you to see something here, how God is going to tie in the nature of the Creator, that's God obviously, Jehovah God, with how we treat other people. And the inference is that if God treats us with love, we're not better than God. We should be treating others with love. Look at Colossians 4 and verse number 1. Masters, give unto your servants that which is just and equal. One of the things that I try to encourage our men to do is round up. Deal with an open hand and round up in business. You're going to find that what goes around comes around. Give and it shall be given unto you. But I believe that we can round up because God rounds up when he deals with us. He loads us daily with benefits. Does God ever round up? By his mercies, we are not consumed. God deals with an open hand. Worst thing in the world, in my opinion, and some of you, your head's about to get shake up and down, is a man that's adamant about his doctrine, but he's selfish in business. It's one of the worst testimonies a person can have. To once again be adamant about his doctrine, yet selfish in business. Masters, give unto your servants that which is just and equal, knowing that ye also have a master in heaven. And obviously the inference is that God is just. God treats us with equality. There's no respecter of persons with God. And if God himself will treat us that way, the inference is there is, are we better than our Creator? So understanding, first of all, how God treats us leads us to be a more compassionate people. But also let me say this, that avoid in understanding the nature of God will lead us to be a less compassionate people. I want us to go to 1 John chapter 4. 1 John chapter 4. Let's notice a few things here in 1 John chapter 4. Then we're going to close with this morning. This is not just a sermon this morning. I'm pleading with us to be closer to what Jesus would have us to be. Closer to the Spirit of Christ. And to rethink 2019. To rethink our goals and our plans in 2019. Just because we can doesn't mean we should. Lots of opportunities are in front of us. 1 John 4 and verse number 1. Beloved, believe not every spirit, but try the spirits whether they are of God, because many false prophets are gone out into the world. And then he says this here. Hereby know we the Spirit of God. Every spirit that confesseth that Jesus Christ is come in the flesh is God. And every spirit that confesseth not that Jesus Christ is come in the flesh is not of God. And this is that spirit of Antichrist, whereof ye have heard that it should come, and even now already is in the world. Ye are of God. And notice he says, you are of God. You are born of God. You've been translated from the kingdom of darkness to the kingdom of light. He said, you're of God, little children, and have overcome them, because greater is he that's in you than he that is in the world. They are of the world, therefore speak they of the world, and the world heareth them. This is what's interesting, by the way. This idea of relevance to the world, and obviously we ought to become all things to all men that we may save them, I get that. But there comes a point where the world, we're only going to be so relevant to the world because the world is not going to hear the gospel message. And so trying to bridge that final gap between believers and unbelievers, I believe is a very dangerous thing, which I believe Andy Stanley is trying to do that with some of his teachings that as we saw a few Wednesday nights ago back in the summertime. By the way, I got another compliment, a strange compliment this last week from a client. I've had two strange compliments over the last year, And those two have been, the first one was, is you say a lot of things that Joel Osteen says, and the last one this week was you say a lot of things that Andy Stanley says. And I'm starting to get a complex about this. But anyway, if you look here in Colossians, in 1 John 4 and verse 7, it says this, "Beloved, let us love one another." Why is this? "For love is of God." It's His essence. "And everyone that loveth is born of God and knoweth God." Do you see here that there's no in-between little wiggle room here that the writer's given? He's saying this, that everyone that is born of God, everyone that loveth is born of God and knoweth God. That's why I believe that we can almost say, rather than lost and saved, a sacrificer or a pleasure seeker. It would be really interesting just to start that. Are you a sacrificer or a pleasure seeker? Well, I didn't ask that. Are you a sacrificer or a pleasure seeker? Well, I go to this, I didn't ask that. Do you sacrifice for people? Because we love Him because He first loved us. And everyone, once again, that loveth, look what He says, "Everyone that loveth not, knoweth not God, for God is love. And this was manifested, the love of God towards us, because that God sent His only begotten Son into the world that we might live through Him. Herein is love, not that we love God, but that He loved us and sent His Son to be the propitiation for our sins. Beloved, if God so loved us, we ought also to love one another. No man has seen God at any time. If we love one another, God dwelleth in us, and His love is perfected in us." See, what he's saying here is that the nature of God is love. Let's go to 2 Peter, 2 Peter chapter 1. And if the nature of God is love, look what God says in 2 Peter 1 and verse number 4. "Whereby are given unto us exceeding great and precious promises, that ye might be partakers of the divine nature." You have received that nature within. You have that nature if you know God. Now, if we go back to 1 John 3, 1 John 3 in verse number 11, let's take a look at this, 1 John 3 in verse number 11 here. First John 3 and verse number 11. I want you to see something here. "For this is the message that you heard from the beginning, that we should love one another, not as Cain, who was of that wicked one and slew his brother. Wherefore he slew him, because his own works were evil and his brother's righteous. Marvel not, my brethren, if the world hates you." We know that we have passed from death into life because we love the brethren. "He that loveth not his brother abideth in death. Whosoever hateth his brother is a murderer, and ye know that no murderer hath eternal life abiding in him." Now, I'm going to be honest with you. We tend to miss verse number 15. You're like, "I don't hate anybody." Well, let's think about that for a second. Proverbs 13 and verse 24 says this. Talk about discipline. "He that spareth his rod hateth his son." If you ask most parents, "Do you hate your children?" They'd go, "I don't hate my children." But if we don't effectively and biblically provide consequence when they do wrong, God says, even though you're not sitting there going, "I hate my son," if you're withholding discipline, God says you're loving your feelings more than you're loving them, because they need correction, because we have sinful hearts. We tend to measure hate by this horrible feeling within, and I didn't go grab a gun and shoot them. But if we withhold something, God says if a parent withholds discipline, he's hating his son. Could it be that we miss verse number 15? "Whosoever hateth his brother is a murderer." We think, "I don't hate people," but if you're withholding, you're being a blessing to other people. This was why this whole idea of just being a Christian by your own and not being accountable to a body. Think about who you're robbing people of a blessing from. You're hating them because you're withholding blessings from them. No man sins in private. If a man sins, let's understand that he's less filled with the Spirit of God. And when he gets in front of people or he gets with people, guess what? He's a diminished blessing to them. He's withheld something from them and he has hated them. You say, that's kind of harsh. We have to say something to jolt us out of our little intellectual securities of thinking that we're loving people. We tend to think, once again, oh, I love them. I had good feelings about them today, and I hope they do well. No, the question is what did you do to give? And if we withhold something, just says that when a parent withholds discipline, he's loving his feelings more than his child, and that is called biblically hate. Whosoever hateth his brother is a murderer. It could it be that what we withhold defines and exhibits hate? And so the question is not so much, have you prayed a prayer? Although I hope that you've called upon the Lord out of a believing heart. For whosoever shall call upon the Lord shall be saved. Is the better question, are you a sacrificer? Or are you just pleasing yourself in your life? This is the only distinguishing factor that Jesus mentions between the sheep and the goats. 2019, great year ahead of us. I'm rethinking Christianity, rethinking ministry, and rethinking it in a better way. And we've said this all along, that we don't have this all figured out. We're in flux. We're in flex. We're saying, God, show us more. And we're asking God, spoil our goods, hopefully. We're asking this, spoil our goods till it hurts. Show us where we can love. Show us where we can be a blessing. And I'm going to go through these questions real quick. Compassion says, who do I need to be thinking about today beside myself? And once again, it's the epidemic of our age, is that people are in this bubble, if you will. Does anybody remember the horrible children's movie called WALL-E? Just confess it if you watched it. Just confess it. Okay? You can confess it. No one's going to judge you. Malachi's watched it. Okay? There's this part in this movie where it has all these people. They're up in space and they're sitting back on these chairs and they're drinking these energy drinks, whatever. And it just shows this total self-embedded, ingrown society within itself, just subsisting. And honestly, I think from heaven's perspective, this is what heaven sees. We just float around in our little chairs, 72 degrees. And this isn't even a joke. This is serious. I mean, it's kind of funny, but it's not. 72 degrees, everything's just perfect. We got our apps that we want. We get our lattes our way. It takes you 5 minutes just to say what kind of a cup of coffee you want. And heaven looks down and just sees us floating around on little chairs, eating our little Slurpees. And while people are so in need of radical love, somebody asked me a few months ago about our shindig, and they said, so what about the shindig you guys do? I said, well, first of all, the church doesn't sponsor it. I said it's really started by Pearl Ministries, and I said, actually, there's very little money that goes with our church with it. There's no big meetings. I said, there's one family who decided to be spiritual capitalists and organize something down here that'd be a blessing to many. Francis Chan has been talking about this for the last few years. How much you can get done when you don't have church bureaucratic red tape and people use their own resources. And I've said this over and over. The reason why Heart Basketball has worked, honestly, is because we haven't had a lot of bureaucratic red tape like the average Christian school. We just go through with it. We do it, and it's been a blessing. But here's the point, is that it's amazing what can be done when you're not worried about, this is what Bob Goff's going to talk about Wednesday night, who name brands it, who gets the credit, it's unbelievable what can take place. It's amazing how the early church turned the world upside down without name branding. I mean, if you knew what took place at the megachurch level, I mean, I've really studied this out. But even some pastors that I respect very well, but they have found in communities that they will name brand the pastor's name, that they actually can sell the pastor's name to the people of the community, and it ends up coming back to the church with families coming to the church and then givers to the church. And so I know at least three or four pastors that I could name them to you right now where the church bought the pastor's books to put those pastors on the bestseller list so that they could say in the community that our pastor is a best-selling author. And then that comes back to the community because they've name-branded the pastor. And if I can name you four pastors right now where that's taking place at. And one of them kind of surprised me. I really want to mention his name because I love his preaching, but I was really surprised they did it. But once you get in that realm, there's no stopping the logic. But Mark Driscoll, Perry Noble, Stephen Furtrick, these churches have all done this. The church will actually pay $250,000 to... When you see these pastors where you're like, I don't even care for their book at all. It doesn't even make any sense. How did they... I guess they're just so popular. That's why their book sold. No, their churches actually bought the book, put their pastor's books on the bestseller list. And what they've done is they're name branding their pastor's name. And then we're the going church. Our pastor's a best-selling author. And so what happens is it's this whole weird world. It's all dealing with money. And it's amazing when you can step away from that and get individuals to do some amazing things. You don't have to brand it. You don't have to have meetings about it. Go do it. Go do it. Shindigs is just one example. I love how the Roberts have taken a lot of responsibility with Teen Pack. Hitting Home is a total example of that. Just to be honest with you, with the marriage conferences, you've heard me say, well, we can dangerously, you know, promote these conferences. And when you see a room like this totally packed with people that are just totally desperate, I just sit there every time. We've sold out the last five events. I just sit there and I go, this is totally amazing. What can you do as a spiritual capitalist that's going to hurt? That people are going to say, are you really sure you should be doing that? Is he mad? Is he beside himself? Or you can just be self-deceived and use Christian principles and build your business, build your life, and then just kind of live for pleasure and just kind of give a little bit here and a little bit there. That's deception. But Christianity says, God, use me. God, be a plunderer of my goods. God, be ravenous of my goods. God, extort me if you will. Spoil me. Take from me. And it doesn't even have to be involving money. It can be the smallest amount of encouragement. It can be the smallest card that you write, that you drive across town and you think of someone else. It can be very powerful.